The bond between a mother and her child is widely acknowledged to be one of the strongest instinctive forces we know. The idea of a woman being forcibly separated from her baby is an almost unimaginable horror. But from the 1940s till as recently as the early 1980s, tens of thousands of WA babies were forcibly removed in state-sanctioned adoptions targeted at unmarried mothers. On October the 19th this year, Western Australia will become the first state to apologise to the women, children and families affected by these past adoption practices. The apology will be made on behalf of the state institutions that engaged in adopting out children under past governments. Christina Cole and Sue are from the Apology Alliance. They've both been campaigning for years to get public acknowledgement of these wrongs, and we welcome them to Afternoons.
Hello.
Hello.
You've both obviously felt strongly enough about this issue to have devoted a huge amount of time and effort to this campaign. Can I ask you first, Sue, what this apology means to you?
I think that what it means for me is that, I suppose if I could just give you a brief history, what started me on this journey, and for me it's only been the last 2 or 3 years, is that I joined a support group and I heard of the death of one of those mothers. She'd taken her own life. And the tragedy of that and the effects on the children that she had left behind, I just felt I had to do something. And that's what took me to my local Member of Parliament and took me into a field of researching, which is where I met Christine, because she's collated so much research over the years. That's when I realised that this terrible injustice had happened and something needed to be done about it.
And for you, Christine?
What has been my impetus was the fact that I had my baby taken at birth. I repeatedly asked to be able to keep my baby and I was told no, I couldn't because I was unmarried. And at the time, this was 1969, and I was only 16, I thought that that must have been the law and that I had no right to keep my child. After 1991, when we were allowed to reunite with our taken children, a lot of feelings came up that I had repressed, and I became very depressed, very anxious, and I started to look at to what was the cause of these problems that I was having. So I joined a support group that had done a lot of research in the past, and I was made aware of what my rights were at the time, and I found that the way I had been treated was not only unethical, it was also totally illegal. That is why I became, and that was back in 1994, so I've been involved with activism and speaking to other mothers and adoptees, you know, since 1994. And now I'm in the process of doing a thesis, which I've titled The White Stolen Generation, to look at the circumstances of the way mothers and children were brutally separated, and also to understand in an historical context of how this could take place in Australia, which purports to be a land where, you know, equal rights and well-regulated and, you know, supporting of human and civil rights. Because what I found, as I said when I joined the group, was that there was a total violation of the human and civil rights of the mothers and their babies.
Can I ask how you felt? And It's hard for anybody who hasn't been through that, but the grief that you must have felt. Can I ask, at the point that you found out that this was illegal, how was that for you?
It was the most shocking experience. It was re-traumatising yet again. As you said in the introduction, one of the most dreadful tragedies that can befall any mother is to have their child taken from them at any time, but particularly, you know, without being able to finish the birthing process, without ever being able to actually see the face of your baby or touch your baby. It is the most, it's like being tortured. With having that happen, you tend to go into, like, close down. It's such a traumatic experience that to save your sanity, you tend to repress the feelings of trauma and grief and shock and panic. All those feelings that come when you're not allowed to see the baby or finish the birthing process, because no one can live. in that level of trauma day after day, you would just literally go mad or, as many women have done, commit suicide. So that all gets blocked. And as when I had the reunion with my daughter, those feelings started to reemerge, as I was discussing before. And then when I found out that what happened to me was illegal, I couldn't quite comprehend it immediately. It took several months, and I'd be driving somewhere, and all of a sudden it'd come over me in a wave that this actually happened to me. It was almost as if a part of me did not want to believe that such a dreadful tragedy had occurred, that you know, it was like for many years, if someone asked me how many children I had, I would say two instead of three. I had repressed the pain to that extent that I would have felt if I'd said three and acknowledged my firstborn, it wouldn't be true. I mean, the mental health damage, that process affected mothers and children, has lifelong effects on both. And not only on the mother and the child, but the subsequent children of the mother, the children of the child that was forcibly taken, because they didn't have the bonding, the finishing the bonding process that babies should be able to complete. And so this has a ripple effect. Then you bring in aunts and uncles and even grandparents. I mean, it's been a myth that it was the parents who were totally involved, in our case, the grandparents of our child. That wasn't the case. In my research, I found that it was when a mother was most vulnerable. She could be a migrant, an orphan, an Indigenous mother, white mother who did not have any family support. She may have been a young woman working in the city, come from the country. I mean, the variants are quite enormous, but the single valuable was that the mother not have anybody there to witness that her civil and human rights were maintained. And so she was preyed upon. I mean, in cases where women were really adamant that they were not going to have their babies adopted and refused point blank to sign any consent, they were often told their babies had died. And of course went into shock and trauma when the now adult child had come presented, you know, themselves on the doorstep. So I mean, the impact, the trauma, and this has not been fully acknowledged, even within the mental health institutions. The level of grief, the pain, the shock, the trauma, is not appropriately or adequately taken care of in the mental health system, and that's another important issue that we want to have acknowledged by the apology, to let the community know that what happened to us was illegal, it caused immeasurable suffering, lifetime mental health problems that need to be adequately addressed, and mothers and their taken children to be adequately supported.
So, and I know this is difficult for you as well. Is there anything that you would like to add?
Similar to Christine, I truly believe that I disassociated. When you're so young and you're dropped at a hospital door and you're met with such disdain and such contempt, you go through labour having a baby and you're treated very, very, almost like an animal. And it's almost, it's like you didn't matter. It's like you're invisible. It's like you were just there to birth this child and be dispensed with. And that sets up a lifetime pattern of not feeling adequate, good enough. It draws people into your life that can possibly potentially abuse again. And there was such a shocking sense of you were worthless, you were nothing. So you had no support, your parents weren't allowed to see you, the baby was taken. I can talk about that now without tears, although they're just there, but once upon a time it would stop me. And you know, like Christine, I mean, I just believed, because I was a minor, that this could be done to me. These are big people. They're doctors, they're hospitals, they're big, you know, gruff matrons. They're, you know, you're just there and you're being subjected to, you know, this tirade of brutality And those mothers that were a bit older or were a little bit wiser and fought, even they couldn't break the system with threats of their child going into child welfare, and which was what was basically said to me at the consent taking. So it was as Dr. Jeff Rickaby says, it was a well-oiled system. And there was, the mother was invisible.
And did you feel invisible? Did you have to
Absolutely.
Almost believe that yourself to mentally cope with what was happening to you?
Well, when I think about it, I've always operated under a personality of confidence. But beneath that is just a part that just has wanted to hide and remain invisible. Because although you're with your pain, it's safe, if you know what I mean. You. It's almost like the level of pain that you've been dealt is so huge that you couldn't possibly take any more. The pain is untenable. It's because it's never been addressed. It's gone pathological, and it's a part. It's an enmeshed in your whole being. It's not something like a normal bereavement where you know it's expected or you know it's and you there's a crisis. We don't go through that crisis. We go to a point in that grieving process, and then we go back and redouble and double take, because there's no acknowledgement. And this is why I fought so hard for the women to know through this state government acknowledgement that these practices were just barbaric. It's not their fault. It happened to them. They didn't do this to their child. It happened to them and their child. This is what I'm trying to sort of say to these women. It was not your fault.
Christina, can we perhaps come back to you? And most of us are aware that in the past that this practice was quite common for unmarried mothers to be pressured into giving up their babies for adoption. But we have quite a sanitised picture of that, I think. In some way, we feel that we call them relinquishing mothers, as though there was some consent. What did it involve?
Well, it was very, very different picture than what's been painted, because the historical record has been written by those who perpetrated the abuses on mothers, who talk about what happened within the institution as reflecting social mores and the time. That couldn't be any further from the truth, for the simple reason that if that was the case, why doesn't everybody know what happened to us in these institutions? Why don't people know the way we're treated? We were disbelieved. People said, oh, that couldn't happen in Australia. And up until we had an inquiry, and there were nearly 400 women who gave evidence, mother after mother basically stated the same abuses that were perpetrated on them. Usually a pillow was placed on the mother's chest, or in some cases a sheet raised up at the moment of giving birth. The concept was to stop the bonding process. It was interfere with the bonding process, because those working in the adoption industry believed that it would help the baby to bond with the stranger mother at a later stage. The other thing that happened was that in many hospitals, a hormone called stilbestrol, which is a carcinogenic hormone, was injected into the mother immediately after the birth to dry up the milk, so the mother was not able to feed the baby. In some hospitals, they had annexes where the mother was taken following the birth and usually heavily drugged, sodium amytal, sodium pentobarbitone, chloral hydrate. These were given at regular intervals, basically so the mother would not fight. This practice was used in Australia up until 1982, when it finally stopped because the Health Commission sent round circulars stating that it was totally illegal, because the mother at the birth was the legal guardian of her child. I would doubt that there would be anyone who could say that they were able to make a decision about what happened to their children. They were either traumatised and drugged. Now, where was the government's duty of care to protect mothers and their children from being illegally separated or from the child being illegally taken, if you have a case like this where this doctor has actually had published that obstetricians should do this, that they should not worry about the law because it was better for a child, genetically speaking, it was a very eugenic orientated article, that it was better for society and for the child. It would do far better placed in an environment with a two-parent family than it would if it remained with its mother and with her family. So, as far as I can see, the government duty of care failed in its duty of care, that was published in the Australian Medical Journal, and the government never acted on that, or there was never any retraction, there was no discussion that mothers and babies should be treated illegally.
If I could just add something there too, Chris. When the Commonwealth were discussing the Model Adoption Act, in terms of the federal government presented a Model Adoption Act to try and bring all the states into uniform legislation, it was well discussed at conferences while that Model Act was being discussed by people within the adoption field that, you know, this practice of removing children from their mothers immediately when they were born was illegal, punitive and cruel. And and Chris can cite the research of those that have said that, you know, it served no medical purpose. It wasn't in the best interests of the mother. It was to break the birth bond so that the child could go for adoption. So, Chris, would you want to enlarge on that?
Well, Dr. Wessel in 1960, who was a paediatrician, in 1960 and 1963 published two articles in which both articles, and they were published in the British Medical Journal, which was well read here, and in a social work journal. And in both journals, he stated that it was unnecessarily cruel and punitive and served no medical purpose to remove a child from its mother at the birth. So, but there were outcries from people within the institution. In 1965, at a national conference, Mary Lewis, a social worker, stated that in many hospitals, people were acting illegally and unnecessarily cruel by not allowing mothers access to their children. There were lone voices speaking out. In 1971, which was a year before the most number of adoptions were recorded, which in 1972 was nearly 10,000. In 1971, they said that it would be not only illegal but morally indefensible for anyone not to allow a mother to see her child at the birth. Yet, as I said before, the practice continued up until 1982. Even though there were people speaking out about it, that the many of the politicians were lawyers. They would have known the law that the mother was the guardian of the child. Justice Richard Chisholm, in the New South Wales inquiry, said that it had been common law and was well-known fact that the mother was the guardian of the child and that she had every right to see and nurse her baby. And this is what I believe, that the society would have expected that. What society was told was that mothers did not want their babies, that they willingly gave them away, that they did that because they could not afford to keep them and because of the stigma at the time. All this is a cover-up and it is not true. The truth is that mothers fought hard to keep their babies. The truth is that they were not told of the social benefit, the financial benefits that were available, or all the other assistances that were out there and had been since the 1920s. Even I've heard a social worker being interviewed a few years ago, and she said, "Oh, there was not enough financial benefits available." Well, from the 1923, single mothers, deserted wives, and widows all had to exist on the same benefit. In New South Wales, that was under Article 14 of the 1923 Act, Child Welfare Act. And then when widows' pensions came in the 1940s, many single mothers actually claimed, and deserted wives claimed those that benefit. There was also, under the Unemployment and Sickness Act in the 1940s, there were benefits available to single mothers to help them keep their children. In 1968, there was the Deserted Wives Act, which was which gave a considerable amount to assist single mothers to keep their babies. And yet, so many of the mothers, or all the mothers that I have researched, none of them were told that there are any financial benefits available. And the social workers at the inquiry said that there wasn't enough to live on. But the fact is that the majority of single mothers kept their babies. In a report by the head of the Department of Child Welfare in New South Wales, he said that 60% of mothers from the period between 1925 and 1976, 60% of mothers over that period of time kept their babies. So yeah, it wasn't the social issue. That was in New South Wales, and I would say that it would be similar in other states. So it was not that there wasn't financial assistance. There was not that that mothers were concerned about stigma. And the women, so I've interviewed two groups of women, women who kept their babies and women who did not get to keep their babies. And the fundamental variable is the mothers that kept their babies had strong family support that assisted them to keep their babies.
You're in Afternoons. I'm Gillian O'Shaughnessy. Christina Cole and Sue are from the Apology Alliance. They've both been campaigning for years to get public acknowledgement of babies removed from their unmarried mothers and adopted out, and the state government will be apologising to these women on October the 19th.
What has happened to these women? I mean, obviously they've come from a range of socioeconomic backgrounds. They've come from a range of places within Australia. What happened to these women after? Did they just go back to their normal lives and try and regain some normalcy?
I think, you know, in many cases, and I, you know, and I've spoken to many mothers, and I look at my own experience, is that it was so traumatising that there was a disassociation process there. And certainly, you know, when I think about my life to a certain degree, a lot of it was one foot in front of the other. We have to go on with daily life, and the mind disassociates, you know. Triggers basically took me back. It took me into therapy, and I've been able to explore this, and as this has happened, you have to deal with what you've been left to deal with, and you need very skilled and good people. There are not enough.
What I mean, how far will an apology go to healing the wounds of both yourselves and of all these women and babies that were so terribly traumatised?
Well, to me, unless a trauma and something that a terrible wrong is acknowledged and validated, you can't even, you know, a lot of women have just spent their lives trying to defend what happened to them. This now acknowledges, hey, this happened. This was awful. This happened in Australia, and this happened to tens of thousands of women in this country, Australian citizens and their children. And it says, you're not alone. It says, you know, this happened. It says, hey, we acknowledge your pain and your suffering. And from that point, women feel validated, supported to go through their healing journey. Up until now, it's such a gloss over of, you know, because they really don't want to open the door on this, quite frankly. They really don't. It's too big. I mean, I think that's indicative, you know, the hospital practices were raised in the McClellan report in 1976 in New South Wales. And it took them until 1982 to tell hospitals to stop. How many more babies were lost in that period of time? I honestly believe that if a mother is given her child and her own mother is allowed in and they share that experience, those children would have been taken home.
Absolutely.
Absolutely would have been taken home. And it was a huge hurt for me that my mother was not there through that trauma. She wasn't allowed. She was not allowed in that hospital. Now, that's shocking. This is before a consent to adoption's even signed.
And I think that's the crucial point, that what happened to us was, as citizens of Australia, was a violation of our human and civil rights. It breached, what happened to us breached many of the international covenants that Australia is a signatory to, such as the child being allowed to be brought up in its own home and know its own identity and its history, etc. This was violated. These are human and civil rights that need to be acknowledged as such. We should never have been placed under any act because the criteria was not met to be placed under the Adoption of Children Act, yet we were as if we'd signed a consent whilst we were still pregnant. And everybody in the hospital and the social workers all acted as if consent was assumed prior to even the birth. So, as I said, we're talking about, you know, really gross violations, human and civil rights violations that need to be addressed. And the apology is an important first step, as Sue said, to having our trauma acknowledged and validated. But the apology will be re-traumatising if the government is not fully willing to take responsibility for what happened to us, because the government is responsible. It should have looked after its most vulnerable citizens, mothers and babies, and yet it failed in its duty of care, and even worse, was involved in these practices. These practices could not have gone on for decades in the hospitals if the government was not aware of it. And they were aware of it because you only have to read the Hansards and you have members of parliament discussing how it was right that mothers should not see their babies, how it was right that mothers should not feed their babies, that it was right that the single mother should make the supreme sacrifice and let her baby go to a couple. These are in the Hansard. So the government was well aware of these practices and never did anything to stop them. And as I said, through the child welfare departments in the various states, they had basically taken on the role of removing the children of single mothers because they deemed them unfit and also because it saved the state money. And if you go back to the early child welfare state relief department reports, in the different states, they have various names, but basically child welfare department annual reports. It's all through every report going back to the 1800s that removing our children was done to save the state money and because they considered us to be unfit as parents, that the children were better placed with couples. So it definitely was government sanctioned and had the support of the government. And for that, our government needs to apologise to us in all the states and federally for this absolutely blatant abuse of our human and civil rights.
You've both been so courageous in your work and talking to us on Afternoons today. It's been a privilege to have you both here with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.